Jacob knocked on Laban's door with empty hands. He had nothing when he fled from his father's encampment, fleeing from his bloodthirsty brother, who rightly was enraged at Jacob's theft of his blessing. Jacob had gone with nothing but the clothes on his back, it would seem. But at the end of 20 years, God has prospered him. We hear stories of people who leave their home, leave their city, leave their country even, and no one hears of them for a while, and then they return and they've got all the trappings of wealth around them. It was a bit like that for Jacob. No one would have recognized him for the transformation that has taken place in his life. But you know, it's not just a transformation in terms of a healthy bank balance and lots of possessions. Jacob really is a changed man. The years, hard years, difficult years, frustrating years for him, no doubt. Those years have done him good. The deceitful man who was willing to lie to his father, deceive his brother, is quite a different man heading homeward. He's had to learn the hard way. We've observed that his uncle was a man that had very similar ways of doing things as Jacob himself. The deceitfulness that sprang up in Jacob's heart was a family trait, it would seem. His mother had it. His uncle had it. But Laban's deceit and treachery ran far deeper than Jacob's. Jacob has been misused by Laban. Even in his discussion with his wives, Jacob makes reference to the way that their father has treated him, and he calls on them to be witnesses. You know that I've served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. Over and over again during those years, Laban has attempted to profit from God's blessing upon Jacob. He had, after all, after 14 years, pleaded with Jacob to remain with him in his house because he had prospered through Jacob's presence there. What he doesn't realize, though, is that God's blessing is upon Jacob, who is following him, trusting him, and not upon Laban. Indeed, Laban is to find not God's blessing, but God's judgment over the following 6 years, as he seeks to swindle Jacob out of his possessions, tricking him through changing wages. Whenever he sees that a certain marking on the sheep are predominating, he changes the wages. When he sees another mark begin to dominate, he changes the wages. And so over and over and over again through these years, he's been watching and calculating and attempting to trick Jacob out of this deal that he has made with him. Jacob has been misused, and Laban's own daughters acknowledge that. It's the first time in this whole sad story that Rachel and Leah actually agree about something and are not quarrelling about it. Verse 14, Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, "Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? He sold us, and he's devoured our money." All the wealth that he gained through the 14 years of Jacob's service, he's devoured it. He's traded it, squandered it, whatever he's done with it. Something that at least in part should have been set aside for them has all gone. They recognize that Laban is only concerned for himself. He's not bothered about Rachel or Leah. That's all a front whenever he seems to suggest a fatherly interest in their well-being. It's all a cover for his own self-interest. Yes, Jacob has been misused by Laban. And so, as the story unfolds, we see Jacob attempting to escape from Laban. Now, this isn't something that he chooses to do by himself. It is something that he has been encouraged to do by the Lord his God. Verse 3 tells us that. The Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you." Had circumstances been somewhat different, no doubt Jacob would have approached his father-in-law and said to him, "Look, it's time for me to go. I've served you 20 years, and it's time for me to return to my father." Later on in this story, Laban himself acknowledges that he understands Jacob's longing to be back with his own family. But circumstances have changed. They're not favourable towards Jacob. Laban's sons are grumbling about Jacob's prosperity. They're blaming him. "Jacob has taken all that was our father's. And from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth." And Laban does no longer regards him with favour. There's something about the way that Laban looks at Jacob that causes shivers to run down Jacob's spine. He knows that there is no love to be lost between him and his father-in-law. So, with these words from the Lord that he should return to his father, he immediately consults with his wives, which apparently was necessary under the law of Mesopotamia, and gets their approval for his decision to return to his own land and to his own people. So, verse 17 tells us, Jacob arose, sets his sons, who are still young, and his wives on camels, drives his livestock and all his property that he had gained, and he heads away from Paddan Aram to return to the land of Canaan, to his father Isaac. He chooses his time carefully. It's no doubt more than a simple coincidence that it's the shearing season when Jacob chooses to go. Laban has gone off to shear the sheep. He will be busy there, a 3-day journey away. And Jacob takes this opportunity. It's going to be 3 days before Laban even hears that Jacob has left. That will set a good buffer between him and his father-in-law should he, as he fears, decide to chase after him. And so he leaves secretly and he heads away across the Euphrates, heading towards the land from which he came. But Laban does hear, and Laban does chase after him. He pursues him for 7 days and eventually catches up with him. And the language that is used here is the language of an army on the warpath. The pursuit, the encamping, the following of Jacob is all using the language of one army chasing after another, running down another with the intent of overwhelming it and destroying it. Which is why God comes to Laban in a dream and warns him, be careful, don't say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Don't curse him, don't bless him. Watch what you say, and implicit in that, of course, is, and watch what you do. Jacob intimates that if it was not for God's intervention, Laban would have sent him away empty-handed. All that he had laboured for 20 years, Laban was the kind of man that would just steal it all away, no doubt make some pretext to put himself in the right. But nevertheless, Jacob recognises that this is a man who is not to be trusted. This is a man of violence and greed. And God has stepped in to enable Jacob to escape from Laban. He's pursued. And Jacob and Laban comes to him with this sort of innocent, grieved accusation. What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? As though Jacob has chained them and bound them and put them in carts and driven them away from Laban, as though his daughters had wanted to stay there, were happy there. Why did you flee secretly and trick me and not tell me? I'd have sent you away with parties. You didn't even let me kiss my sons and daughters. Oh, it's in my power to do you harm, but your God has spoken to me. Well, it's a confession that it's not in his power to do Jacob any harm at all, because God has intervened. This was the thing that Jacob had said to God when God had promised that he would be with him, and that he would bless him with the blessing of Abraham. If you will be my God, if you will bring me back in safety to my father's house, then I will serve you. Well, Jacob's not waiting for the proof of God's trustworthiness. Jacob's already trusting in God. Along this hard road that he's walked, this road of being misused by Laban, being under threat from Laban, being tricked and cheated by Laban, through all of this, Jacob has seen God at work. God has prospered him despite what has been going on there. And Jacob is now a man who trusts in the Lord. He knows that God can protect him and bring him home safely. Yes, he was afraid of what Laban might do, but nevertheless he had this trust in God. And so he himself confronts Laban. I haven't taken anything that's yours. All of this vast wealth that surrounds me here, you go through it all and show me, set it before our kinsmen who have accompanied you here, and show me what it is that I've stolen away from you. So Laban goes through all of Jacob's possessions. It's interesting, isn't it, that he goes through Jacob's tent first. He obviously doesn't trust Jacob at all. He goes through Leah's tent, goes through the servants' tent. He goes through Rachel's tent. And of course we know that Rachel has in fact stolen from her father. She's stolen some household gods. These were small images of ancestors that were worshipped and also that were used for divination. We've already seen that Laban's confessed to using divination in order to understand his circumstances. And the question that we need to ask is, why did Rachel steal these household gods? Now, there are two interpretations of these events. There are those who suggest that Rachel did so because she was a worshipper of these false gods. She wanted to take them with her, that they were a guarantee of an inheritance from that side of the family, and that they would be a protection for her in the journey. And then there are those who say, no, that doesn't seem to be the case from all that we see of Rachel. Her confession of God, in terms of Jacob's being prospered despite Laban's cheating him, and also the fact that we don't meet with any instance of Rachel or Leah or anyone else worshipping these gods, though they are mentioned again in the 35th chapter when Jacob tells them that they need to remove all of these household gods from their camp. Put away the foreign gods that are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go to Bethel, the house of God, so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress. The suggestion is rather that Rachel is attempting to thwart Laban by taking these idols which Laban uses for divination, and that he would consult, no doubt, in order to try and assess which direction Jacob has gone in his pursuit of them. Rachel has a indifferent, at least indifferent, attitude to these gods. For when Laban walks into her tent and begins to poke around looking for these household gods, she says to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." She's in her monthly uncleanness, an uncleanness that in that day and age would contaminate. Her confession of her condition would have meant that Laban would not even have considered even the remotest possibility that these gods would be in the saddlebag that she was sitting on. She had desecrated these gods by doing what she was doing. And it's another indication not only of her own cunning in deceiving her father, but also of her regard for those gods. If she truly had been a person who honoured those gods, then she would have found another hiding place. She would not have done what she was doing there. Now, no doubt it has taken Laban some considerable time to go through Jacob's possessions, to search through his tents and come out empty-handed. In the meantime, Jacob has become increasingly angry. And then he judges Laban, berating him with these words, "What is my offence? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me?" Laban's claim is that Jacob has stolen from him. And Jacob will, in this outburst, demonstrate that in fact it's Laban who has stolen from Jacob, or at least tried to. And but for the God of Abraham, he would have succeeded. And Jacob would have been leaving Paddan Aram empty-handed. Laban doesn't know how to answer. Verse 43, the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, all that you see is mine. Well, it demonstrates his own view of the situation, but certainly it's not a just one or a true one. And he really acknowledges that. If he had any just claim, he had witnesses before him, he could have made a claim upon those things. He knows that Jacob's accusations are correct. And so he responds with the suggestion that they make a treaty between each other, a treaty of peace, a treaty of non-confrontation. Let's make a covenant, you and I. Let it be a witness between us. And so they set up this pillar and these stones that are to be a visible expression of this agreement that they have made, that they will not cross by this place in order to do harm to one another. We notice that Laban swears by his gods, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, and what would be properly translated, the gods of their fathers. He's a man who worships a plurality of gods. In contrast, we see that Jacob swears by the fear of his father Isaac. Now that's a term that Jacob uses to refer to his God, to Yahweh. We see it earlier in verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, now we would expect, and the God of Isaac, but he doesn't use that term, he uses the fear of Isaac. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac. Now he just uses that last phrase, but it's the equivalent. Jacob is swearing by the God of Isaac, by the God of Abraham. He acknowledges one God. And he swears by that one God. This is the God who has brought him safely through these 20 years and has given him wealth in the place of poverty and life in the place of death and a family when he was all alone before. The words that God had spoken to him as he had seen that dream of a ladder reaching up to heaven. Those promises that God has made, Jacob has seen them be fulfilled, or at least begin to be fulfilled, even in his life. Jacob is a changed man from the man that left Haran all those 20 years ago. He is steady, honest, patient, hard-working. We witnessed that last time. He's a man who over and over again acknowledges God. Throughout this story, there's a definite acknowledgement that God has been in control of his circumstances. You know, that's such a contrast from the man who left those 20 years earlier. A man who was self-serving and deceitful and manipulative in order to get his own way. Here is a man who has learned to trust God, even in difficult circumstances, and he acknowledges that repeatedly in this chapter. And then he's a man who separates himself from everything that associates him with this deceitful man Laban and his gods. Even as they enter into this covenant with one another, Jacob refuses to have anything to do with Laban's worship of other gods. He swears by only one God. It's been a hard road to change. And we can read through these chapters, and you know, in a few minutes we read the story of Jacob, and we forget that years pass. Years of frustration, years when things are not going his way. When he must have lifted his hands and shrugged his shoulders and wondered, what's going on here? 7 years he works a dowry for a wife that he loves, and he's tricked into marrying the ugly sister. Another 7 years of labour for this man, and at the end of 14 years he has nothing but two bickering sisters as wives with their servants. Another 6 years of hard labour in which every loss he's had to pay for himself, where his wages have been changed over and over again, where Laban has done everything that he could to upset Jacob and hinder Jacob. Oh, these could not have been easy years, and they didn't pass slowly either. Didn't pass quickly either. They must have dragged by, and he must have been frustrated over and over again. Do you ever feel like that? Does it ever feel to you as though everything's a mess? Things are not working out. What is going on here? I thought that God was supposed to be a God who will take care of me, that will provide for me, that will protect me, that will enrich me and bless me in a thousand ways. And my life just seems to be falling apart. Everything I put my hand to, just nothing seems to be working. Does it ever feel like that? Well, it must have felt like that for Jacob. And yet, through all of that, this man has become a steady, honest, hard-working, loyal follower of God. Through every changing circumstance. And he's proving God's faithfulness now as he makes this journey home. Oh, he's not a perfect follower of God. We'll see him stumbling along this way yet. But he is a man who trusts in God. He is a man who follows God. He's a changed man. Now, this story is prophetic. It's prophetic of what will happen to Jacob's descendants. I mentioned it last week, that Jacob's time under Laban in servitude is a forewarning of what will happen to his descendants in Egypt. Jacob's fleeing from Laban, and Laban's pursuit of Jacob is a forewarning of what the Egyptians will do in pursuing the Israelites as they flee from Egypt to the promised land. Jacob's being enriched at Laban's expense is a foreshadowing of the enriching of the Israelites who, for decades, if not centuries, have been enslaved and therefore not able to accumulate wealth, and yet their neighbours freely give them of their wealth and enrich the Israelites as they leave Egypt for the promised land. In so many ways, Jacob's life experience is prophetic of the experience of the Israelites to come. And that itself is prophetic of the experience of Jesus Christ, the true Israel. And it is Jesus Christ, and it is his life and his death that is able to bring true and lasting change to us and to our lives. It's able to transform us from self-serving, self-centered people into a people who are willing to give of themselves in the service of God. It is, in fact, in some senses, a foreshadowing of our own lives. The lives of slavery that we live to sin, and the deliverance that God provides through Jesus Christ, and the enriching that we have with him, not with physical wealth, but with spiritual wealth, a wealth that will last for eternity. But we need to remember that all these promises that God gives in this book of beginnings, that he gives to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, are promises ultimately that don't see their fulfillment in an ethnic Israel settling in a promised physical land, but they find their ultimate fulfillment in the salvation of people enslaved to sin being brought into the kingdom of Jesus Christ, into a new heaven and a new earth. That's where these stories are taking us. And we need to walk in Jacob's footsteps. And we need to trust God in the hard times, in the difficulties, and to know his blessing upon us. To be assured that one day we will receive the reward. Even though everything may be confusion to us now, we trust this God, who is a faithful God. We trust the God of Bethel.